This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you suffering from illusions about alternative energy? Have solar panels become a pointless fetish that could make climate change worse? What about electric cars? Is the whole green energy game just an extension of the fossil fuel industry, dressed up in green clothing? Those are the claims made by a California engineer and a student of alternative energy. Ozzie Zehner published all this in his 2012 book, Green Illusions: The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism. The book has won awards and caused quite a stir. For this Radio EcoShock program, I'm going to run you a talk given by Ozzie on September 19, 2012. It's part of the Authors at Google series, and there were green energy techies from Google in the audience. We'll get some questions from them, too. Before we start, let me say categorically that I agree and I disagree with Ozzie Zehner. He gives us fundamental truths about the need to stop wasting so much energy. Reducing energy cuts our impact on the planet and climate change like no other strategy. Of course, we haven't cut back at all, and global greenhouse gas emissions are increasing every year. But then Ozzie tries to tell us solar and wind power can't work. In fact, if applied in a widespread way, Zehner claims that would destroy civilization as we know it in one generation. So here's the deal. This week, I'm going to run Ozzie Zehner's Google Talk. Next week, I've got a green tech expert to give us a different view, and I'll present my own research into all this. Before you give up on green energy, be sure and listen to next week's Radio EcoShock show as well. Ozzie is introduced by a Google software engineer, Valera Zakharov.
Hello. Welcome to our Green at Google and Authors at Google Talk series. My name is Valera Zakharov, and today we have a pretty uncomfortably exciting talk for you today. We have with us a local San Francisco-based author, Ozzie Zehner, and the book is called Green Illusions: The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism. And the book has been causing shockwaves, as the Sunday Times reported recently. And it's been pretty eye-opening, actually, and interesting to follow some of the debates raging out there on various internet resources. Meanwhile, Ozzie has been busy with his book tour, so he's done a lot of appearances on environmental segments, some of which have been featured on CNN, PBS, BBC, and public radio. When he's not on the road, Ozzie is a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, where he researches the social, political, and economic conditions influencing energy policy priorities and project outcomes. I'm also proud to say that Ozzie is a fellow engineer. He has an engineering degree from Kettering University and a graduate degree in science and technology from University of Amsterdam. Before we get started, let me do a little poll. How many of you guys own an electric or a hybrid vehicle here? So that's great, because Ozzie is not planning to talk about that part of the book today. I think it's going to be a pretty relevant talk to all of us. We at Google are committed to building a sustainable future, both as individuals and as a company. And at the same time, we love and we believe in technology. So with that in mind, actually, Ozzie told me that he's really looking forward to our perspective, and so he's looking forward to your questions and feedback at the end of this talk. So without taking any more time away from that Q&A, I would like to welcome to Google the author of Green Illusions, Ozzie Zehner.
Thank you very much, Valera. And thank you very much, all of you, for coming today. I really appreciate it. And thank you for those tuning in online as well. I'm going to speak for about a half an hour and then take questions and answers. So I know you're all very busy, so if you want to leave after the talk, that's fine. If it's that bad, you can leave during the talk. This is not going to be a lecture about how we must think or how we must talk. Rather, I'm going to consider how we might think and talk differently about our energy challenges. Now, you will all be designing the built and conceptual environment that we live in. And as such, I suspect you will be answering a lot of the questions that I'm struggling with. And so the story we will lay bare today is far from settled. This really is my hope that you will help complete it. So let's get started. The premise of my book, Green Illusions, is essentially that green technologies are not what they seem. They might not be what you think they are. They might not be the saviors that they're made out to be. And I argue that alternative energy technologies rely on a way of legacy thinking. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I wanted to start actually with a little bit about my history. I didn't always start, I wasn't always a green energy questioner, I guess. Actually, it was just the opposite. And I once founded and operated a vertically integrated wind power operation in Michigan when I was 12 years old. And I was very stylish at that time. And I ran my short-lived wind power operation out of my parents' house. And behind our house was a garage. And inside that garage was a turbine, thanks to my dad's job at an industrial fan manufacturer. And I found a rusty steel pipe to kind of use as an axle. And I had to build a kind of a wooden frame. My parents had neglected to teach me to weld, so I had to go with wood. And I had also not secured any funding for a tower, and so I used a picnic table. And then one windy day, I hauled the contraption out onto the picnic table, lifted it up on there, weighed it down with bricks, inserted the turbine assembly, and there was very little time to appreciate my work because it started spinning uncomfortably fast, very rapidly. And at that point, it had become apparent that I had neglected to install a braking mechanism. So I grabbed a brick and I shoved it against the axle, and it was like sparking and hissing, and the steel sails just effortlessly accumulated greater speed. And in a sense, I had created an upended lawnmower that was kind of thumping with an increasing rhythm. And at first, the frame was vibrating, and then the whole picnic table started vibrating. And really, what happened thereafter can only be deduced, because by that time, my adrenaline-filled legs had already carried me halfway around the house. But when I returned, I found an empty picnic table in flames. So this was the first of many failures in my life, actually. There was another one. We don't have to go through all of them. But when I was 17, I built a hybrid electric car that also ran on natural gas. And it was not very fast. I'm pretty sure it was not safe. And it got stranded in the halls of my high school and so forth, but not before I got a photo op at the local paper. And after that, I went to engineering school. And I worked in green tech in Europe for several years. And when I moved back to the United States, I decided to start a green architectural firm in a historic district of Washington, D.C. One of my first clients was a diplomat who wanted to live in a solar house. And of course, I love solar cells, so it seemed like a good fit. And he already had the building. It was this 100-year-old house that had seen better days. And about the same time the house was built, someone had planted two oak trees on the western side of the house. Well, actually, I have no idea. I wasn't there 100 years ago to witness who exactly planted the trees. But I can guess that that was probably the reason. But regardless, these trees were great because they blocked the summer sun. And in the winter, the leaves would fall off, and they would allow the sun to shine through the branches and warm the home's exterior. And this kind of passive solar technology is eons old. So as a result, the annual utility bills for this house were thousands of dollars less than a house that was just down the street that was brand new. And these trees had been doing this every year for 100 years. And as a green architect, my first job was to chop them down. Yeah. And the solar cells demanded it. As this man pointed out, you can't put solar cells on the roof of a shaded house. And I would soon find out that this was the first of many demands that the solar cells would make. And demand number two was for lots of money. And if you read anything about solar cells these days, you'll likely be left with the impression that solar cell costs are dropping and the price curve looks something like this. But over the past decade, the installed cost of solar cells actually looked like this. So why is there such a discrepancy? Well, part of the reason has to do with subsidies. Subsidies give the illusion of a price drop when really just someone else is paying for it. But there's a little bit more to the story than that. Journalists, for instance, point to the price of polysilicon and the technical components of solar cells. And indeed, those costs are dropping. But polysilicon, for instance, represents just a fifth of the cost of an installed solar system. The bulk of a solar system is low-tech things like copper, glass, aluminum, framing, transportation, installation. You still have to pay for all of those, even if the price of polysilicon were to drop to zero. And so those things get pretty expensive, especially when you start getting into things like the rare earth metals and the heavy metals, which incidentally brings us to our next demand of solar cells, is that they require some pretty toxic stuff. Now, solar cell manufacturing involves the use or release of numerous compounds, explosive compounds and toxic compounds, like this cell here, which contains cadmium, like most thin film technologies, which the EPA recognizes as a toxin. Now, what happens with this at the end of its life? If we incinerate this, it goes up into the air and eventually into the waterways. And if we bury it, then it can leak into groundwater supplies. And not very much of this is biodegradable. So today, that's not a big deal. Solar cell generation is tiny. In fact, it supplies less than 0.1% of America's power. Now, if solar cell production grows, then so will the associated side effects. But to my dismay, the demands of the solar cells did not stop there. The United Arab Emirates recently conducted one of the largest cross-comparison tests of solar technologies to date. And they did so because they were building this eco-metropolis called Masdar City. You might have heard of it. For this test, they gathered a whole lot of solar cells from a lot of different manufacturers. And their goal was to find which manufacturer had the best solar cell. But once this test began, it drew attention to something else, which was the disadvantages and limitations that all of the solar cells shared in common. So a desert might seem like the best place to put a solar cell, and indeed it's one of the best, but there were problems. The first was haze and humidity, which reflect and disperse the sun's rays. The next was dust, which technicians had to scrape off almost daily. And in other parts of the world, you have to deal with pollution, hail, snow, ice, these sorts of factors. And the third was heat. So right in the middle of the day when the solar cells should have been producing their highest output, they got incredibly hot, which hobbled their output across the board. Now, in addition to all of these effects, solar cells age, and their output fades by about 1% a year. The newer technologies degrade even more rapidly than that. But an even larger surprise awaits solar cell owners. After about 5 to 10 years, their solar array will suddenly stop producing power. And that's because a key component of the solar system, the inverter, will eventually fail. Now, solar cells can last 20 to 30 years, something like that, but inverters don't. The inverters have to be replaced about 2 to 5 times during the life of a solar system. Fortunately, any electrician can easily swap one of these out, but unfortunately, each one costs about the same as a furnace. And incidentally, there's one more reason I'll mention why solar array can stop working. This is Glenda Hoffman's roof. She woke up one morning to discover that thieves stole 16 panels off her roof as she slept. And in fact, solar thefts are on the rise nationally, and the cost to replace her system chimed in at about $95,000, an expense that her insurance company covered. But nevertheless, she intends to protect the new panels herself, and this is what she told the New York Times. Now, a lot of people say that these demands are worth it. If solar power yields less CO2 than fossil fuel power, then does this offer a justification for subsidizing solar cells? Well, first we have to consider costs. Even some of the most expensive options for dealing with CO2 would become cost competitive long before today's solar technologies, making solar cells perhaps seem like a rather wasteful strategy. Why would we, for instance, mitigate 1 ton of CO2 using solar when we could mitigate 5 tons or 10 tons elsewhere for the same cost? Secondly, solar cell manufacturing involves the use or release of other types of greenhouse gases. And these are used to make solar cells, and they make CO2 seem harmless. These greenhouse gases are 10,000 to 25,000 times more potent than CO2, according to the IPCC, and we are now learning that these gases are one of the fastest growing emitters of these gases is the solar cell industry. So I was in the position of having to explain all this to my client, and I didn't really know where to start, but I had to list off these demands. I mean, they demanded that we retrofit the roof, first of all. They demanded that we purchase locks and insurance. The solar cells demanded regular cleaning. They demanded expensive inverters every 5 to 10 years. They demanded a lot of money. They demanded an expensive funeral. They demanded to be buried in a toxic, especially sealed toxic waste plot. And of course, they demanded that those pesky trees would have to be chopped down. Now, think for a moment, what would you have done if you were in my position? What would you have advised my client to do? Well, here's what the numbers look like. For every $100 he spent on solar panels, he would produce this much energy. For every $100 that he spent on LED lighting, he would save this much. The value of the trees, the added insulation, and the efficient appliances would be even greater. In the end, I advised him against a solar cell installation, and instead told him that he should keep the trees and spend the money on energy efficiency and energy reduction techniques. And the long story short is that I was fired. And that's because he had already made his decision. The solar cells were going to stay. And the trees, well, now my experience was not unique. For instance, an old grove north of here was chopped down to install solar cells. And the oil company BP chopped down 42,000 trees outside Brookhaven National Laboratories for solar. A company, not an oil company, but another company in New Jersey, took down about 5 acres of trees to build a solar array that would power a facility to make plastic bags. So, I kind of think that puts a new spin on paper versus plastic. But again, we might think it's worth it to offset dirty coal use. But it's important to note that none of these solar projects will offset the CO2 debt from clear cutting the forests that they sit on, for reasons we will come to shortly. The solar cells also will not replace the other benefits of the forests, such as things like air cleansing, water filtration, and trails, and other benefits. The fate of these trees is ultimately a casualty of a certain way of thinking, a presumption that the way to solve our energy problems is to produce more energy. The ethical implications of this remind me of a movie that I just saw last month, a classic film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Has anyone here seen the movie? Oh, wow. Let the record show that almost everyone raised their hand. So you might remember a computer named Hal. Hal was programmed to carry out a certain mission, and he followed that mission without consideration of the changes around him or respect for human life, as it turns out. Hal thought, if the astronauts are endangering the mission, then turn off their life support. If the trees are blocking the solar cells, then chop down the trees. This is a kind of mission-directed ethical trap that we sometimes fall into because we're human. And that's typically because we think we have a good idea, a good sense of our ethical bearings, and our job is to apply them to our daily life. But as you all know, ethics can often be more than that. Now, as you all know, Google ventured into China, for instance, to expand its mission of bringing more information to more people. But in order to expand its mission, it was required to censor search results. Now, Google refused to censor the search results, and this is a good example of how ethical reasoning is more than just applying our ideals to the world. It's more than just a mission. It also involves looking at the world, seeing what we can see, and then letting those visions inform our ethical thoughts. But there's a lot that can get in the way. For instance, when I spoke with my client, I made the mistake of thinking that the facts could speak for themselves. I made a mistake of thinking that my crude calculations would be enough. But this wasn't about the facts. This was about something else. Now, we've been told that solar cells are clean, and we know that energy from the sun is limitless. And we've been promised that they will be cheap. And we've been seduced by solar cells. And this isn't the first time that this has happened. For generations, our energy bucket has been leaking. And the leaks here represent energy waste. And in the United States, most energy does nothing productive at all. It just leaks out, according to the Department of Energy. But that's not all. The leaky bucket is also getting larger. And that's because we love cheap energy. Politicians subsidize energy production, and when cheap energy is available, demand, of course, goes up because people want more of it. And so it brings us right back to where we started with so-called insufficient supply. And this applies to alternative energy as well. And in fact, there's no evidence that alternative energy offsets fossil fuel use in the United States. And I know that didn't seem to make sense at first. But consider the expansion of hydropower and nuclear power. They would both presumably decrease coal use. As recently as 1950, in fact, hydropower filled a third of the nation's electrical grid. That's hard to imagine today. But they did not quench increasing demand, and demand increased. And the United States met that demand by building more fossil fuel plants, not fewer. Today, hydropower fills just 7% of the electrical grid. This is a boomerang effect. The harder we throw energy into the grid, the harder demand comes around and hits us on the head. So larger solar cells and taller wind turbines are just ways of throwing the energy boomerang harder. And in fact, the history of energy in this country is very much a story of throwing the energy boomerang harder. Long ago, whale oil was considered to be clean, cheap, and limitless. I mean, one whale might contain 3 tons of oil. Who could want more than that? And we poured it into the leaky bucket. And eventually, whales were in short supply. and they were expensive. But explorers had found something better. Their fossil fuels were cheap, they were cleaner than whale oil, and as any driller could tell you, they were limitless. But that was still not enough for the leaky bucket. And physicists had found something else. Nuclear power was clean, it was cheap, and it was limitless. Well, of course, that turned out not to be the entire story, but the bucket was still growing and really leaking. Which brings us to the next. Now, there are ways to stop the boomerang effect. And there are ways to lower fossil fuel demand. And we'll consider those soon. But first, I have a few questions for you about this bucket. What amount of solar energy would fill this bucket? Will this much do it? What if we double or triple the solar cells in the United States? I mean, it would be possible. It would cost a lot of money, but it's possible. What if we multiply solar cells by 100, which would incidentally bankrupt the federal government? And then we added in 10,000 utility-scale wind turbines. Would that fill the bucket? Or will it fuel the bucket's growth and make us even more reliant on fossil fuels? Now, common knowledge presumes that we have a choice between fossil fuels and green energy. But alternative energy technologies rely on fossil fuels through every stage of their life cycle. Most importantly, alternative energy financing relies ultimately on the kind of economic growth that fossil fuels provide. Alternative energy technologies rely on fossil fuels for raw material extraction, for fabrication, for installation and maintenance, for backup, as well as decommissioning and disposal. And at this point, there's even a larger question. Where will we get the energy to build the next generation of wind power and solar cells? Wind is renewable, but turbines are not. And alternative energy technologies rely on fossil fuels. They are, in essence, a product of fossil fuels. They thrive within economic systems that are themselves reliant on fossil fuels. Now, I'm no fan of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are finite, they're dirty, but we use them for five principal reasons. Fossil fuels are dense. Their energy is storable, portable, fungible, which means they can be easily traded, and they are transformable into other products like pesticides, fertilizers, and plastics. Now, these qualities cannot be measured in kilowatts. So what happens when we spend our precious fossil fuels on building alternative energy? Well, then we get energy that is not dense, but diffuse. It's not easily storable, it's not portable, it's not fungible, and it is non-transformable. Now, to increase the quality of the energy, we then have to spend more fossil fuels to build batteries, to build backup power plants, and other infrastructure. And of course, this is incredibly expensive. And ultimately, that expense represents the hidden fossil fuels behind the scene. Now, there's an impression that clean energy could supply a growing population of high consumers. There's an impression that alternative energy can displace fossil fuel use. But the evidence doesn't show that. Now, before I move on, I should mention, but at this point in the story, my architectural firm is toast. It's gone. But luckily, I'm somewhat geeky and willing to spend long time in front of a computer. I don't think I'm the only person here that fits that description. And when gas prices rose from 2003 to 2008, they shot up, you might remember that, then I stayed safely in the library. And as part of my academic research, I studied a data set of 50,000 articles that were written over that period of time when the energy prices were going up. For every doubling in oil prices, coverage of solar, wind, and biofuels shot up 400%. But I also looked at energy reduction strategies, things like home insulation, light rail, LED bulbs. We've witnessed the impressive payoff of these technologies, and so we might expect the coverage of these technologies to also be relatively high. But this is what the media coverage looked like. And this was not just a media phenomenon. Does anyone recognize this building? It's quite a ways from here. This is a green building in Chicago's Millennium Park. And to be a green building, the architects might have super insulated the building, but they didn't. They used glass, which allows the building to bake in the summer and lose heat in the winter. They might have outfitted the building with energy efficient lighting, but they didn't do that either. they might have incorporated overhangs to block the high summer sun, but allow the winter sun to shine in. Or they might have used light shelves to toss more light into the building's interior. But they did none of these things. This building is a green building because it has solar cells. The California Academy of Sciences, just up the road from here, has solar cells in one of the foggiest microclimates on Earth. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation has solar cells that are partly shaded by the structure itself. This BP station has solar cells, and some don't even face the sun. There are solar cells right here in Mountain View, being consecrated in this photo. They also don't face the sun. In fact, none of these buildings has solar cells that face the sun. But you see, that doesn't really matter. Because these architects were not building buildings to be energy efficient. They were not building buildings to reduce fossil fuel use. They were building temples. They were building temples to technology, temples to solar energy, temples to the idea that the way to solve our energy problems is to produce more energy. Now, consider for a moment that solar cells were a puppy. So maybe a chihuahua, maybe a furball like this one. If solar cells were a puppy, I imagine that this is kind of what they would look like. Not real big, not real smart, but super cute. And we all like to take solar for a walk. And academics get grants for walking solar. Industry gets good PR for walking solar. Government enjoys being out with solar as well. And when elections roll around, all the more reason to take solar out for a stroll. And, media likes to walk solar, and so does the public. Well, maybe depending on their political affiliation these days. But I'm fascinated by solar. And I bet I'm not the only person here that is. And sometimes, Gene, just a puppy, solar gets tired. But there's always someone around to pick solar up and keep going. Even if it's just to walk to the park and walk in circles. Now, let's consider a walk with energy reduction. Now, reduction is a huge dog with a lot of potential, as we have seen. Well, though walks with reduction differ from walks with solar, reduction's walks include many more stops to pee, and which is made all that more difficult without the trees. So why go for walks with reduction when the walks with solar are so much more fun? And that's what we need to understand. We need to understand and figure out ways to organize walks with reduction that are more fun and interest all of the dog walkers. And that's going to be a lot more exciting than you might think. For instance, how might we plug leaks in that energy bucket? I'd like to consider for a moment junk mail. The junk mail industry claims 100 million trees a year, which producers must grow, cut, haul, process, print, and then ship to homes where they are usually immediately thrown away, hauled, processed, and finally dumped. Now, one study equates the energy bill of this cycle to 11 coal-fired power plants running continuously around the clock at full tilt. And all of these power plants go to power something that most people don't even like. So in Germany, this is what they did. They created this little sticker that says, no thanks to junk mail, and I have one right here. And this sticker in Germany is legally binding, so most Germans choose to put this sticker on their mailbox. In the United States, these stickers would help patch a small hole in our energy bucket. And you might think that's no big deal. It's just junk mail. And in fact, it probably isn't really that big of a deal. But it's important to point out that these stickers would have a greater energy impact than all of the nation's solar cells planned and existing combined. We don't have an energy crisis. We have a consumption crisis. And a lot of that consumption goes toward things that don't make us any happier or healthier. Let's consider the growth of that bucket. Much of this results from unsustainable population growth, but how can we ethically achieve a sustainable population without infringing on the reproductive rights of individuals? Well, we know that women who are entitled to civil and economic rights, who are in control of their own bodies, can enjoy the freedom of bearing children at their own rate, at a pace that is perfectly sustainable overall. But consider this chart in the United States showing pregnancy and abortion rates in several countries. A girl growing up in the United States is 4 times more likely to become pregnant than a girl growing up in France. And an American girl is 3 times more likely to have an abortion than a girl growing up in France. And among industrialized nations, America's teens are the least likely to use birth control due to stigma, lack of health care, and high costs. And we are now treading in territory where environmental and social problems converge. And that is a vast, unexplored wilderness. Lowering teen pregnancy rates would greatly benefit the nation's girls. There's no doubt about that. The energy and environmental benefits could be a welcome side effect. So how do we stop the growth of the bucket? Solar cells, wind turbines, and biofuels can't do it. Healthcare and human rights can. And as unlikely as it may seem, universal healthcare would have a greater energy impact than all of the nation's solar cells, wind turbines, biofuels, and geothermal combined. And it would cost less too. A lot less, in fact. In fact, none of these proposals costs much money. None of these proposals leads to lower standards of living, just the opposite, actually. And while they are not high tech, they rely on the same foundations of human ingenuity and creativity.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to an Authors at Google talk by the controversial author Ozzie Zehner. His book is Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy and the Future of Environmentalism. Next week, we'll run a critique of this presentation.
The real clean energy is less energy. But this is a shift in the way of thinking that is not available to many people because you cannot see energy savings in the same way you can see and even worship a solar cell. I set out to build a solar house. But what I did not initially see, what I failed to recognize, was that this shabby house with its 2 oak trees was already a solar house. Alternative energy fetishes have so greatly consumed the public imagination that the most vital and durable solutions go overlooked and underfunded. But therein lies the opportunity for you. You may be asked to think of environmental solutions in terms of energy production. Perhaps you already have. And when that happens, you might be willing to think or ask, is that part of the solution or part of the problem? If we are to understand the ethics of alternative energy technologies, then we must first see what they do. Alternative energy technologies don't clean the air. They don't clean the water. They don't protect wildlife. They don't support human rights. They don't improve neighborhoods. Alternative energy technologies do not strengthen democracy. They do not regulate themselves. They do not reduce consumption. They don't reduce atmospheric carbon dioxide. They don't stop the leaky bucket from growing. Alternative energy technologies produce power. And we generally associate more power with greater prosperity. But in fact, if we look to the world's 10 happiest countries, they use less energy than Americans do, 40% less. So these happy countries value things like architectural techniques that make buildings more efficient and comfortable. They also prioritize walking, biking, and public transit. And finally, successful regions value human rights and healthcare. In contrast, alternative energy technologies yield low-quality energy, and they rely on fossil fuels. They also create a host of negative side effects. But they don't always only rely on fossil fuels. They're based on fossil fuels, from their financing to their decommissioning and eventual replacement. Alternative energy technologies are essentially rebranded fossil fuels. Now, what will people think about alternative energy in 10 years from now? Will they think of alternative energies as clean, or will they see them as the next round of ecological disaster machines? Now, don't get me wrong, I don't claim to know all the answers. I'm just another member of the search party, like you. But it certainly seems that there are a lot of unanswered questions. In fact, it actually seems that there are a lot of unasked questions. And by asking the hard questions, you will be better prepared than anyone else to address the rocky times ahead. And as energy prices become more volatile, you will have the conceptual tools to make a difference. You will find your skills will be sought after. In fact, they will become necessary. It's not a question of whether or not we have the technology to create an alternative energy society. The real question is the reverse. Do we have a society that is capable of being powered by alternative energy? And the answer today is clearly no. The bucket has too many leaks and it's still growing. But we can change that. As the illusions surrounding alternative energy technologies continue to unravel over the coming years, you will have some choices to make. Will you remain rigid in your defense of the green legacy empire? Will you turn off the life support in order to protect the illusory mission? Or perhaps you will adapt your thinking to the larger challenges that we face. Or maybe you will go beyond adaptation and anticipate those challenges and be an innovator in the next green movement. A green movement that is not simply a receptacle for energy firms and car companies to plug into. A green movement that looks beyond the eco-gadgets on the stage to consider the social and environmental injustices behind the curtain. Clean energy is less energy. And the future of energy will not be a story of wind turbines, solar cells, and biofuels. It will be a story of livable communities, improved governance, healthcare, and human rights. And it is not enough to say that we would benefit by shifting our focus. Our relevance, your relevance, may very well depend on it. Thank you very much.
This is Radio EcoShock, your green source. Our speaker is Ozzie Zehner, author of the book Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy, and the Future of Environmentalism.
Hi.
Hello.
First, thanks tremendously for your talk and for writing this book. I'm a Googler that follows energy issues. I've been on the website called The Oil Drum for many years, where we're commonly referring to alternatives as fossil fuel extenders, not replacements. So thank you very much. I look forward to giving your book to other people to help them, educate them. But I would like to ask a somewhat personal energy issue. I'm building a home right now in the rural part of the island of Hawaii. A grid connect is extremely expensive, prohibitively expensive, and even then the grid is like 70% naphtha burning or something like that. So I can do obvious things like LED bulbs and the like, but in fact, the fact that I'm choosing not to use propane for most of my, you know, say hot water needs, whatever, is viewed as insane by the status quo, all the electricians and plumbers you might be able to hire anywhere. Have you got, and now, you know, my concept of using solar for hot water, which is intermittent, solar for solar electric, has just been shot down in flames by your presentation. Have you got any advice for, I'm not alone in this. There are tens of thousands of us off grid in the Western United States.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'd be happy to comment on it. My research is in the larger social scale and in political contexts, not in individual projects. So I can't really make, that much of a comment on there. But I can say that it probably doesn't really matter because when you have, if it's a vacation home or a home on the Hawaiian island and it's far away from civilization and it's disconnected from the grid, it probably is no way you can make that green. So, I mean, that's just an unfortunate kind of reality. I mean, unless you were to move there and sell all of your possessions and just, you know, live off the tree, eating the fruit that falls off the trees. And of course, this is the problem that everyone runs into. None of us can really make our lives totally green. And so that's why I feel that we need to concentrate on those ways of moving forward that bring a lot of people in, bring a lot of interests in. And actually, when we look there, when we start to look and think about solutions in those terms, we find out that a lot of the solutions don't really decrease living standards or require sacrifice. They just require coming back to the basics. Kind of like if you're looking at buildings, that might be the basics of solar insulation and using passive solar techniques. And if you're considering the larger scale, things like healthcare, like I discussed in the talk, would have massive benefits for the environment and for human populations. So they're not always against one another, the two can work together. And that's where we have to find, that's where we find the sweetest opportunities.
I totally get your point about how handling consumption is much more important than generation, or much more impactful. That said, I wanted to just get your ideas on a few things in terms of three questions that come to mind. One is in terms of the solar panel for providing energy versus just using direct heat, for example, hot water heating and so on. That must be, I'd imagine, a lot less environmentally toxic and fairly efficient. Second one would be when you use these energy efficient things, such as fluorescent bulbs and LED lighting, I've been concerned about the amount of pollution that comes from the fluorescent bulbs, and I would assume the LED lighting has its own types of things. The LEDs may last, you know, for almost forever, but I'm sure all sorts of other things in those lights break, and then that's toxic waste, right? So I was wondering if you could give guidance on that, the solar water heating, the energy efficient lighting, and a third thing is the electric vehicles. When I look at whether to buy a high efficiency combustion engine versus to use something like a hybrid electric vehicle, I see that they have a lot of problems with the recycling of the battery. Some amount of it enters the environment. There's the production of it. Or even if we consider just holding on to your old car for longer, if it's, you know, within emission specs, you avoid putting all that energy consumption into creating a new car. So I've never really been convinced that going out and buying a new hybrid electric vehicle is going to be a good thing to do.
Yeah. Thank you for those questions. So for your first question, the solar hot water, that's a perfect example of a low-tech option that makes a lot of sense in a lot of locations. It doesn't have a lot of the side effects that solar cells have. It has side effects of its own, of course, but they're minimal compared to the benefits that you get. So your second issue was with other types of light bulbs and energy efficiency. And energy efficiency becomes even a larger issue than what you're bringing up with the toxins and the light bulbs themselves, because we have rebound effects that occur with energy efficiency. As things become more efficient, people use more of them, and it can overall increase consumption. So that's another side of the energy efficiency story that I didn't have time to talk about today, but I cover in the book. And then there's the issue of the light bulbs. And of course, LED light bulbs also contain all kinds of nasty stuff. And so do mercury, compact fluorescents. And I use LEDs as kind of a comparison in my research, because in many ways, they're similar to solar cells. They're high tech. They were both developed around the same period. They were both used in space programs. They're both associated with a lot of high tech industries. And they both contain heavy metals and toxics and things like that. And so there's no like easy green fix to that. It's just weighing one set of side effects against another set of side effects, and that's really difficult to do. And this also speaks to the electric car issue that you talked about. Because when we look at electric cars, we see the same thing. We're used to looking for side effects in one location, which is basically out of the tailpipe. But the side effects in an electric car happen somewhere else. And so it's very difficult to see them or account for them. And so we assume that the electric car is clean, of course. But the National Academy of Sciences did a study, a life cycle analysis. It's the broadest life cycle analysis done on electric cars. And they found that the harms stemming from electric cars are a little bit larger than the harms stemming from a regular internal combustion engine of a car the same size. In fact, the only way that we can really find that electric cars are cleaner is if we narrow our research to just one metric, like CO2. If we just narrow to that one metric, then we might be able to make an argument that electric cars are cleaner. It looks like it might depend on where they're charged, and and then it starts to get murky after that. But if we look at the whole life cycle, if we looked at what do you do with the batteries after, how much energy is used to get those batteries, what are the side effects, what are the epidemiological impacts of the pollution, and this is what the National Academies looked at. They actually went county by county and did epidemiological studies and figured all that out and accumulated it all. And they said, you know what, your electric cars, they run on both.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to Ozzy Zehner. He's talking about green illusions. Next week, we'll get a different perspective.
So I been writing about a lot of these topics for the same, and saying many of the same things in your, in the first half of your talk for a long time about the megawatts and the bad math that a lot of people do about alternative energy. But I've not come to the same conclusions you have. And I'm wondering what you use to back up the idea that, that it's likely we could conserve our way through a crisis. Is there any examples from history of people doing that, being able to solve problems like this through conservation and greater efficiency rather than what's usually happened throughout history, which is new technologies coming along and changing the equations? It's obviously difficult to say with any accuracy what exactly the technology of the future will be, but it's always incorrect to say the technology of the future will be the same as the technologies of today. And that makes this prediction difficult. An example of you making one of the same mistakes you accuse all of everyone else of making, I saw in your chart talking about light rail as an energy efficient technology. Light rail is the least energy efficient per passenger mile technology we use for transportation in the United States. It's worse than an SUV, in terms of the amount of energy it uses. And yet you put it up as, here's an example of why aren't people writing about this. We make these mistakes all the time. What back to basically the question is, what examples from history can you show of conserving to get through a crisis?
Okay. Thank you for asking that. Well, with regard to light rail, the benefits from light rail come in the context of the communities that they enable. So it's not in the light rail itself, but it's in the ability for people to live in a dense urban context. Dense urban contexts are a lot more energy efficient because people live in smaller buildings or closer together. They're not losing as much energy for heat. So you have to look at the whole context for light rail.
Thank you for your technology. Both Ben and I are working on a car that drives.
Oh, yes.
This technology, which means vehicles that deliver themselves, that can take themselves to fueling stations, uh-huh. are interesting implications, is really going to change how people move in cities like this. And nobody thinks about it right now. It's one example of
the future changes of technology is certainly something that I'm aware of and I embrace. I mean, the technology will change. And we have to be prepared for that as well. But ultimately, a lot of technologies rely on energy. And so energy becomes a roadblock that's very difficult to get through. I just listened to a talk actually from Bill Gates where he makes this point. And he says, you know, energy is not high tech. It's not Moore's Law. Moore's Law does not apply to energy. It's because you have to deal with physics. And unless you can find a way around the physics, you're still left with any technology, any growth in society, any growth physical. From a physical perspective, is going to have to be powered in some way. Of course, Gates' solution is to have the nuclear reactor. So the problem is you either have to believe that infinite growth is sustainable over the long term and that an infinitely growing population is sustainable over the long term, or we can look to what examples are there of dealing with the whole issue with conservation. And there really are no good large-scale examples of that. I mean, we're watching it happen with Japan right now, which is probably the place to look. And one of the other speakers that was here at Google, James Howard Kunstler, was recently on a blogcast with him in which he mentioned something really curious. And he said he thinks that he says all kinds of fascinating things that make me think. and he said Japan is basically going back to a craft society where he uses kind of like this as kind of a thought experiment to say, look what's happening in Japan. Their population is rapidly decreasing. And they're changing their societies in ways that have never been done in advanced industrial societies before. And so I think we can maybe look to countries like that and see what might be happening, what might come several decades down the future. But no, you're right. There's no good model for it.
Thank you for speaking. I think your points about reducing consumption are very interesting. But it was interesting because almost every single statement you made in your talk, I wanted to ask a follow-up question to understand better, which was provoking. The one that I think is perhaps the most important to me to clarify at the moment is you said a lot about how green technology and alternative energies like solar panels require fossil fuels to build and deploy and recycle. And do they require fossil fuels per se, or do they just require energy? Like if we had hydro and solar, you could presumably just take the same electricity and build the plants with those. They don't logically require coal. We just don't have enough existing infrastructure yet. Is that Am I right, or are you saying something that I didn't understand?
No, that's a really good point, and this is another big question that I can't fully answer because it's in a way, in many ways, it's unanswerable what might happen in the future. We need the energy. Yes, you're right. The problem is that certain types of industries rely on certain types of energy, so it's difficult to explore for copper and bring the trucks out there if they're only running on electricity. That's why we use fossil fuels for that. And so the cost ends up going up significantly if you try to replace certain types of energy for other types of energy. And yeah, ultimately it's the energy, but there's also qualities to energy that go beyond kilowatts or the amount of energy. Like I brought up the fungibility and the storability and the transport. And so these are all qualities that we have to keep in the back of our mind. And it's difficult to really put those in a spreadsheet because how do you measure those and how do you compare them across different energy technologies?
So let's say you're declared the dictator of the United States tomorrow.
It'll be a sad day for the United States.
Well, yeah, hypothetical. Or the world, whatever you prefer. What changes would you make to the existing system, let's say policy changes or something like that, to make people move in the right direction? So, for example, like, let's say removing the subsidies and making technologies reflect what they truly cost throughout their life cycle might be something, but you showed that it doesn't work. Because solar panels really aren't as effective as reducing your usage. So what kind of changes would you make if you were the dictator?
Ooh, well.
Sorry, loaded.
Yeah. First of all, yeah, there would be Lucky Charms in all of the restaurants. So. I think probably universal healthcare would be the number one priority. I feel like universal healthcare has so many benefits, and we often hear people say, oh, I don't really want to pay for that person's health care, and it's just like the person's going to go to the doctor too much. And well, first of all, that's kind of like a remarkable breakdown in civil society. It represents kind of a remarkable drawback from that perspective. But also, most people don't recognize that we already have an emergency universal health care system in the United States. When a homeless person goes into the ER with pneumonia because they didn't have health care, they end up spending a lot of money on bringing that person back to health. And, of course, that system is incredibly expensive. And that's why we could actually save money by going to something like a universal healthcare system like the ones in Europe. And there's nothing about the healthcare systems in Europe. They're not perfect, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But you also don't see Germans in the streets protesting for an American-style healthcare system. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind, too, with all the rhetoric going back and forth on these issues. The other things that I would enable, to make a short list, is the kind of energy efficiency enabling technology or research, a department of efficiency instead of a department of energy. And also things like removing zoning restrictions that prevent density in certain urban contexts can end up having a big impact. So that's probably the direction I would go. Where I should make a clarification that probably our views are not incongruent in that I'm not for population control. I should say that right off the bat. In fact, I think the idea of population control within the environmental movement, and there are some people pushing for population control, and I think that's a misguided effort. And that's because I do think it tramples on the ability for societies and for individuals to have a free life and procreate how they choose to. But we find that actually coercion is not necessary at all. If you look in China, the lowest birth rate is in a place where the one-child policy does not apply, in Hong Kong. And we find that throughout the world, there are, actually Shanghai also, which doesn't apply. It doesn't apply in Shanghai, also has a low birth rate. We find that really by just instituting human rights and healthcare, it allows people to have the number of children that they want to have. And that number happens to be sustainable over the long term. And so really the trick, I think, is just delivering human rights and healthcare in the first place. I really see population growth as a symptom of suboptimal social conditions. So the real thing to do is to just satisfy those social conditions, and the population growth will take care of itself.
I had one other question. I think we're getting low on time, but I was curious what you thought of the work of like Professor Jacobson at Stanford and others who have come out and said, look, we have the technology, we have the resources to power all of the energy in the world today with existing known technology for wind, water, and solar. And how you compare that with your graphs of showing, you know, the tiny drops compared to the very large buckets. Do you think his analysis is wrong, or do you agree with it and we're presenting something different?
I was actually just on a radio show, NPR, last week, and he was on the show. And The issue with this report, which you're referring to for people who don't know, is that basically there's these ideas that there's enough solar energy in the Mojave Desert to power the entire of the world. There's enough wind power to power 100 times what we need and these kinds of things. And really, these are just a failure in the way of thinking. I mean, of course, if you ask a ridiculous question, you can find a ridiculous answer. And I mean, the Mojave Desert may be the Saudi Arabia of solar. But if we were to cover it with solar cells and cover the world's deserts with solar cells, it would destroy civilization as we know it within a single generation, just because of the toxins, the fossil fuels that would be required, the other climate gases that are produced that are many times worse than CO2. If you take that little dot of solar energy that we get currently, or wind power that we get currently, and then multiply those side effects by something like 10,000, that's what you're looking at. So you just get another set of side effects with alternative energy technologies, and they all rely on fossil fuels, so you don't. Thermal solar has the same side effects. When you get back down to it, you end up with the same types of side effects. The high cost of thermal solar reflects the fossil fuels that are behind the stage.
So is it accurate to say that you think in that report they didn't do a proper life cycle analysis?
I don't think they asked the right question.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I don't think. I mean, maybe their findings are correct, you know? I could ask the question, how many threads of linen are in this carpet? And I might be able to find an answer. But is that really a meaningful question to be asking?
Hi there. Thank you. Great talk. I'm not as well read as some of the other questioners, but I'm curious why nuclear is not mentioned anywhere and whether you think that there's a place for it in the future world. Thank you.
Thank you for asking. That's an excellent question about nuclear. Nuclear would be a whole series of talks aside from this one, which is why I didn't talk about it here. I do talk about it in the book. So if you're interested in my views on nuclear power, you can look there. But nuclear is a fascinating case because it is something that is actually scalable. And there is a lot of fissile material on the planet. And that can be looked at as a blessing or a curse. And there's people that look at it from both directions. The issue with nuclear power is that we have yet another set of side effects and limitations and consequences. Some of them we know very well. Some of them are risky situations that are growing and accumulating over time, such as that with waste disposal and access to proliferating materials like plutonium. And even, you know, the nuclear armaments industry has even tested byproducts from the thorium cycle in anticipation that there might be a thorium push in the future. So when we look at conflict, we look at potential for materials getting diverted. We look at long-term storage of nuclear waste. We look at the potential for explosions or like Fukushima disasters. And so we just get another set of side effects with nuclear. But the big issue with nuclear that shouldn't be underestimated is that there is a lot of fissile material on the planet. And we're going to run into different types of barriers with nuclear than we're encountering with fossil fuels. Oh, I'm not the right person to ask about the ITER projects and the fusion reactors and things like that. Fusion has been kind of 30 years in the future now for a very long time, but we're now kind of finding that you know, the future isn't what it used to be, and it's getting more and more difficult to really see a way forward with things like fusion. But I mean, maybe it will happen someday. I don't really know. Thank you very much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. That was Ozzie Zehner, author of Green Illusions, The Dirty Secrets of Clean Energy, and The Future of Environmentalism. He was speaking at part of the Authors at Google series in California on September 19, 2012. This talk was lightly edited for radio, and due to time limitation, questions about healthcare and population control had to be more or less cut out. You can view the full talk on YouTube. I've got links to that and to Ozzie in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We are out of time this week, but don't give up on all your green hopes just yet. Next week, I'll be back with green tech investment guru Dan Miller. He thinks Ozzie is just plain wrong. I'll add my own research into this, some very different conclusions reached by other scientists and from Radio EcoShock guests, plus ideas on where we go from here. Don't miss next week's Radio EcoShock show. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. And thank you for caring about your world.